listeners. So I'm really excited about this episode. It's Daniel Kolitz and moi. Daniel is the journalist who wrote the Love Bomb article. And you'll hear in the episode, he was working on that article for 4 years. He really put his heart and soul into it. And you can tell from the results. So we get to talk a lot about how, you know, why he started writing the article and what it was like through the process and the effect that it's had on the community. And, you know, Daniel and I are just, we've become good friends over the years. And so it was just a, you know, it was a really great conversation. I'm excited for y'all to hear it. I think that, you know, when this episode comes out, I will have done my live interview with Mike Harper on Twitch. So I hope that that goes well. I hope that, you know, on the other side, I'm happy about the results and getting ready to put out some great episodes. I've got some great interviews lined up over the next few months. And then we'll probably take a break for the holidays and then pick back up in January. And hopefully in January, I will have the new website up and running. It's going to be gorgeous and it'll be a good place for resources and things like that. So without further ado, here is Daniel Kolitz.
Hello, hello.
Hello, Daniel Kolitz. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yep, that's it. All right. Oddly, okay. Rarely pronounced wrong. You would think people would get it wrong more often.
It's the Z. So my maiden name is Sazzy, S-A-S-S-A-S-Z-I.
Okay.
And it's like, it's, you say it just like it looks, like okay. Sazzy. Yeah. Like it's not, whoa, what just happened? That was weird.
Did something happen?
Yeah. One of my browsers just popped up. But people would see the Z and be like, how do you pronounce your name? And it was like, Sazzy. But people called me Sazy. And of course, Sassy. I was called Sassy my whole life. But
as a nickname or as a, you know, it's not as bad as it could be.
Yeah, 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 for sure. And it was appropriate. It's an appropriate nickname. So Daniel Kolitz, I'm so excited to do this.
Excited to be here.
The tables have turned. Now I'm asking the questions. And really, I just wanted to do this because you're so pertinent to the whole movement, you know? And I honestly, not only are you pertinent, but like your article is really what changed everything, is how I feel about it. It brought a bunch of us together. There are a bunch of people that, you know, maybe would not have ever connected had it not been for, you know, you writing the article and you kind of connecting all of us. And so I just think it's important, you know, to talk to you and talk to you about that whole process and just your life, because you've been telling our stories for so long. And I think it's time that we learn more about the man behind the Atavist article.
Yeah, happy to reveal anything. That is very kind and overwhelming of you to say about the article. I mean, I think obviously your guys' efforts are more important here and the work that's being done in activism-wise, but means a lot to hear that.
I mean, I would say equally important. And so I just want to tell you this. I think I've told you this before, but I don't know, maybe not. So you know that since like 2016, I've been, you know, wanting to shed light on all of this. And ever since I saw Leah Remini's Scientology series, I was like, we need something like this for, you know, Bob Meehan. And I reached out to a couple of like ex-staff members that I knew and was like, hey, let's, you know, I tried to start a podcast back then and nobody was into it. Like everybody that I talked to was like, yeah. And understandably so, like nobody wants to dig back into their trauma, you know? And that's kind of what you have to do if you start talking about this stuff. And it's hard. It is really hard. And we all have lives, we all have careers now, and no one wants, you know, a potential employer Googling their name and finding, you know, I was in a cult. That's, you know.
Yeah.
And I was just at this place where I was kind of working for myself. And I just hit this point where I was like, I don't care. Like, we need to get the word out there. And I just felt like I was hitting walls, you know, and I just kind of let it go. Like, all right, well, you know, maybe this will never happen and, you know, whatever. And then Mike Harper, who's actually going to be on the podcast in a couple weeks, we were friends on Facebook and he posted, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was something like, spent a couple hours talking about the abuse I suffered from my employer or something. And it was the first time that I had heard the word abuse used.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. When it came to those programs, because I mean, like we would all, you know, those of us who started talking about it and being like, hey, so that was weird. Right. We never used that word. I mean, we would talk shit and we would be like, this was so weird. And this was so mean and those kind of things. But I don't think I had never at least looked at it as abuse. And then sure. I saw that word and was like, holy shit, that was abuse.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I realized that you hadn't conceptualized it that way until just a little bit before I spoke with you.
Yeah, no, I really hadn't. And because it's a weird thing because I think it was, I could look at, well, no, not really. When I hear the word abuse in that context, I think child abuse. And I wasn't a child. I was an adult when I was there, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's why I had a hard time with it. But it was just like the first time. And then I sent him a Facebook message and was like, who are you talking about what I think you're talking about? And who are you talking to? And he gave me your number. And the rest is history.
Yeah, I mean, this had gone on for so long that I almost forgot how helpful Mike Harper was. This would have been maybe like 2.5 or 3 years ago at this point. But yeah, he was tremendously helpful in setting all of this up. It's interesting you say that because I feel like I've heard that from a lot of people that like 10 or 15 years would pass before they would even start to think about what had happened or conceive what had happened to them as like somehow wrong.
Yeah.
It's interesting, that weird like time delayed reaction to being an enthusiastic sobriety. I mean, I think a lot of people leave and maybe have a sense of like not rightness, but don't know how to articulate it or don't think to articulate it until later on or if ever.
Yeah. Well, and we all leave so broke, you have to jump right into like, how am I going to pay my bills next month?
Yeah, right. You run right into the fire. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I was homeless. Like I didn't, you know, I had been asked to move out of the house I was living in and I had nowhere to go, you know, and so I had to figure out and I was behind on all my bills. I hadn't paid my car payment in months and my car was all I had, you know, because I was like, I might have to sleep in my car. Like, we'll see what happens.
Right.
And so I just had to find and I had been applying to jobs, you know, before the people I was living with kicked me out. It was 2009 and it was right after the 2008.
Terrible time to go out on your own. Yeah.
And the last time I had to look for jobs or apply to jobs was 1996. So I just was like, I'll just hit the streets and find a job. And that was not the case. So I just took what I could get, but yeah, I think so many of us have to like, just jump right into figuring out how to move on. And they set you up, you know, they talk so much shit about people who leave to the people who are still there. You're also terrified of being that person. Right. So it just takes time. And I'm glad that that's changing. I'm glad that we're seeing staff members leave and pretty quickly be like, you know, how do I talk to your reporter, basically?
Really? So has that, I don't even think I'm up on that. I mean, is that something that's been happening? Have people been leaving in recent months? I mean,
I don't know recent months, but I know back when the Facebook group started, there were a couple people, two that I know of and that I know personally and have interacted with who had just quit like 6 months before the Facebook page popped up. And I was like, oh, you know, go easy on them because it's going to be years before they can admit anything. And and that's not the case. Both of them were like, fuck that place.
I spoke to one person like that. It was fascinating. It seems, I don't know if it's social media or if it's, I mean, probably a big part of it is this kind of amazing Facebook group that, that now exists. That lets people kind of ping their stories off one another. But I do wonder, I mean, I probably told you this, I don't totally remember, but a few days after the article came out, I got an angry message from someone purporting to be, I believe, like I guess, what is the term? I'm forgetting, a group member on the brink of graduating. And they said they just wanted to have a civil conversation with me. And it was clear they were very pissed off.
Right.
And, you know, I was home alone. I had nothing going on. So I just, and it was like 1 a.m. So he'd sent this number. And so I was like, all right, I'll call him up. So I called this guy up and he was like, hello. I was like, hey, this is the reporter. He's like, what? Sorry. He seemed really disoriented. He's like, I didn't think you were actually going to call me. And, you know, he said, give me a minute. I'm going to go outside. He goes outside, gathers his composure and starts asking me like, so like, is it all lies? Like, how do you know that this is true? Mm-hmm. And I started explaining that we have a pretty rigorous, you know, fact-checking process at the Atavist. Everything in there is true. And he doesn't really have much to say to that. But he does tell me that basically the article, it was circulated on Apple News and it popped up as a notification on everyone's, a bunch of group members were sitting around. It all popped up at once on their phones.
Oh, wow.
And so they clicked onto it. And so it's, I assume it's being read by people who are active members of the program. And I wonder how that's changing their perceptions, and then especially the existence of, as mentioned, these kinds of groups. And you know, I wonder what's happening. I wonder if it'll be a quicker transition process.
I think so. On. I really think so, because we didn't have it. I mean, we didn't have anything like this, and everything that happened in 2005 with On the Emmis.
Right.
You know, was so, I mean, Daniel, I was so terrified. I had never seen the 2005 news story until this year.
Really?
Yeah. I had never watched it all the way through.
Wow.
And I don't, it's weird. And I had never been on the Emmis. I hadn't looked at any of that, even because, after I left.
Was that because they were sort of, why was that?
It's hard. Like, I would get this, like, feeling in my stomach and I would start shaking. Like, that's how, I mean, because the way that they talked about it was, well, number one, because I was on staff then, so I was dealing with the implications of it from the inside.
Right.
Which was horrible.
I would imagine.
And I mean, I really feel for some of the newer staff who've never been through anything like this. And that's why, you know, when we started all of this, like when this group of us got together, one of the things that I was like, this is absolutely a deal breaker is we make sure we're not causing more harm to the people who are there, because this is going to be very difficult for them, staff and kids in the group.
Absolutely.
And parents. And, so, yeah, so I think that was a part of it for me, is it literally triggered what I went through. I mean, I had reporters calling me at step two. Yeah. I was not prepared for that. I didn't know how to talk to the media, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, it would bring up those feelings, because I remember I went to look, like, around 2014, I was online and I was like, I'm going to look it on the Emmis, and I couldn't do it. I got too, like, like, I felt like I was going to throw up and I started shaking and I was like, okay,
no, that makes sense. Yeah. I mean,
that's how bad it was. So, I do think that all of this will probably help people, sort of come out of the fog a little bit quicker, you know?
Yeah, I hope so. I really do.
I do too. I really do. But yeah, so that's why I say that article, you know, was just so important, and you did such a good job of, you know, giving all of us a voice and really explaining like being able to, what I really liked about it is it's, because it's equally as important to me that people who have never heard of the program understand how damaging it is.
Right.
Because it's so hard to explain to people. And that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, is like what that process was like for you of getting your brain around, like, what the fuck is happening here? Sure. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's one of the things I think is so important about your article is that there are people who had never heard of Bob Meehan or Enthusiastic Sobriety Programs who were able to get a good idea of like, oh, this is not okay, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was an education on my part because it was not, I mean, it was immediately apparent, right, when I started reporting it that something was wrong. But then I remember in the very, very early stages, so this would have been like early 2017, trying to explain it to people. And I felt like something was missing. And people had said that to me too, about how they would get out and try to explain it to people. And they couldn't seem to convey the full weight of why it was damaging or why it was weird. And I struggled with that myself. But I think it really was just a process of kind of sticking it out. I mean, it took so long just to wrap my head around the names of the different branches, all the different techniques, all the different key players. And again, maybe I think if I was I had never really done a project like this, I think maybe if I was a more seasoned journalist, this process wouldn't have taken quite as long as it did. Mm-hmm. But I think it ties into what we were saying before about how people don't realize something bad happened to them necessarily because so much of it is subtle and so much of it is not like, you know, 10 of us were tied up in a basement and hit with boards and, you know.
Right.
Starved for 2 days. I mean, you know, you have like those programs like Straight Ink.
Right.
Or whatever. Sorry, I'm using my mother's computer and my father keeps trying to call her and it's making a sound. My own computer, I'm currently using an $85 laptop, which is not good for teleconferencing purposes. But anyway, yeah, I mean, so much of it is subtle. So much of it has to do with, you know, disassembling someone's personality over the course of a very long period of time, and very subtly rebuilding someone or building, you know, alternate values in them. I mean, at least that's how I experienced it or interpreted it, that I think you needed. I mean, Dave Cherry was the person I went with, and the reason that we kind of told his story at such length was that I think that, you know, you could have told that about anyone in many respects. Just you need to show one person sort of experience with the program from
start like their to downfall
their indoctrination, their downfall, to try to convey, you know, what it feels like and what exactly this program does to people, because, you know, Dave Cherry's experience, it was bad, but it wasn't unique. There are so many people, even just on the group member level, who have undergone similar experiences, and you know I think the reason the article is so long is, I mean, because the group has been around for half a century somehow. And then also because it takes a while to explain to a person how someone can end up this way or end up, you know, sort of following these beliefs and how the whole thing works.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yes.
No, it totally does. And I'm glad we talked about that, because that was one of the things, and I know you experienced this too, that came out of the article, was a lot of people were pissed that it was mostly about Dave Cherry.
Yes, absolutely.
Which at first was kind of surprising to me. Like, I was like, who cares? Like, you know, because I understood, because I know you and we talked so much and I knew so much about the article, I understood why you used him, but I had to kind of take a step back and go like, oh, if it had been all about Renee, I probably would have been pissed too.
Yes.
I didn't experience the abuse from Dave like other people did. And he was, you know, I mean, he was around for a while and he was not nice.
No, you know? Sure. Yeah. And, you know, I heard that from people in the course of reporting it and tried to some extent convey that, you know, he was as tied up in it as anyone.
Right.
But I don't know. I guess a part of me felt and does feel that Dave kind of really made serious amends.
Yeah.
I know there are people that are hesitant to forgive him, but
yeah,
you know, he went through a lot as well. I mean, but part of the reason also that Dave was essential here was a structural thing, because, you know, we needed to find someone that spanned 4 or 5 different eras of the program. So if you're starting in, I mean, he was we came after PDAP and after Freeway, or around the same time as Freeway.
Yeah.
So in the mid-1980s. And he's there through the dissolution of Freeway, the formation of the weird St. Louis network, Lifeway stuff that was going on. He's there for Ice Cap. He leaves. And then he's, you know, obviously crucial in the kind of 2005 expose stuff. And I, you know, I also want to take a moment here to shout out Dave Larson, because, you know, the way that I can see it, he is
absolutely
as an integral a part of this. And from, by all accounts, is like an amazing guy. I mean, he, you know, seems to be, he is an amazing guy. And you too. I mean, let us not shirk you as well. I mean, this story could have been told. Part of my regret, I mean, this story was, I think, probably even 50% longer. And there was more about you, and there was more about a few people that I wish we could get in there. But also, I mean, as we know, the story isn't over yet.
Yeah.
And I think that people's different roles and narratives will come out. But yeah, I mean, it is, I certainly understand why some people were rubbed the wrong way.
Yeah.
By Cherry being sort of made the central figure of the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, again, it's, I mean, this doesn't help those people. And I completely 100% empathize and understand why people feel that way. And I also want to put out there that, you know, like I said, there's a bigger picture to that article going out. You know, it was for survivors, but it was also like, it's time, y'all. Like, it's been 50 fucking years of these people being able to continue doing this. And we've got to get the attention of the rest of the world.
Right.
And Dave's experience was a good way to do that. It was a good way to do that.
It is a heartbreaking story. And, and he has a lot of great perspective on it and can speak to it very eloquently. I mean, not to say that. What I've actually found is, because it's interesting, because so many people that go through these programs are forced to talk about their feelings so much. Seriously, they all become amazing interview subjects because they're very in touch with how they're feeling, and they're very eloquent about their sort of internal deliberation processes. And so, I mean, you know, many of the people I spoke to were super eloquent, but Dave, he can kind of narrativize, dramatize his experience in a very useful and compelling way.
Well, and he was really, like, he was in it, you know, like, he was Bob's guy. He was very close to their family. And so, it was good to have some of that inside perspective. And it was so interesting for me because there were so many stories he told that I had heard from Bob and Joy and Clinton, Wendy and Renee and Byron that were very different when they were told to me than, you know, from what Dave's, you know, account was of them.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that in doing it, so I, you know, I went and kind of got Dave's account in full early on, but part of the task of the piece was kind of taking Dave's account, taking Dave Larson's account, taking all of these different accounts, taking like a, you know, six-sided perspective on one situation, and then merging them to arrive at some version of objective truth. And obviously the actual truth of any situation is unknowable except to, I don't know, some kind of robot, some higher power AI.
A ghost that might have been in the room.
A ghost that might have been in the room. But and even that ghost might have their own biases, depending on who they were in life. But
good point.
But so that was kind of the fun. I mean, fun is maybe not the word, or maybe it is. I mean, it is kind of interesting to take different perspectives on a situation and try to meld them and arrive at, you know, a version of truth that's palatable to everyone who was there.
Yeah. And that kind of brings me to, I don't know if everybody knows how you even got on to all of this. So
I don't even know a little bit about
that whole process.
Sure. I was actually just describing this to my mom a few hours ago. So it's a completely random story. I mean, I was trying to find things to write about at a certain time in my life. And I find that actually to be the absolute hardest part of journalism, not the reporting or the writing, but just finding a subject that is worth writing about.
And yeah,
it doesn't happen very often, maybe once or twice a year, which is why I don't publish very much. But in any case, one of many reasons. But I was basically, I put together like a multi-Reddit, what you know that is, like you get like 50 subreddits as a kind of feed that you can browse through and look at the posts. And I would just go through that, power scroll it every day, looking for something, I don't know, something that caught my eye. Mm-hmm. And nothing ever did. I mean, this went on for months and months and months. And then one day, it was actually, I remember the night before the Women's March. So wow. I guess a few days after Trump's inauguration, because I remember, I remember describing it to someone at the New York Women's March. I found this woman had posted something saying like, "Help me! I've lost touch with my daughter." Mm-hmm. And I clicked on it, and there was some reference to enthusiastic sobriety. It was kind of cryptic. I wasn't sure what was going on at first. But I kept looking into it. She had posted some kind of PDF explaining her situation. I contacted her. I called her. What's funny is that, so I spoke to this woman who posted this cryptic Reddit post, still not really understanding what the situation was.
Right. Not knowing what you were getting yourself into.
No, not at all. Not realizing this would determine the course of my life for years and years. But she actually, so I went back and listened to that call and the fact-checking process at the end, and realized that she had mentioned Dave Cherry way, so the very first conversation I ever had about this, Dave Cherry was mentioned. The name didn't register at the time, obviously.
Right, so yeah.
You know, I could have saved myself some time, but I didn't realize who she was talking about.
Right.
But, you know, she explained to me just a kind of a localized situation of what her daughter was going through. She didn't explain the history of these programs. And then, you know, there is information online. I mean, not a lot of it, and it's scattered. But if you kind of look at the 2005 ABC expose,
yeah,
you look at the 60 Minute stuff, you look at you know, so whatever kind of remnants of On the MS are still online or, you know, in the Internet Archive, I started piecing together that this was like a decades long story. And every time I spoke to someone, the story would just get deeper and deeper. But in the beginning, I was mostly talking to kids that had just graduated this program. This woman who had lost touch with her daughter put me in touch with one of them, who then made a Facebook group and added like a bunch of, they must have been between 18 and 21 or something. And I was just going through and systematically talking to them, but they didn't really have a sense, nor did I, obviously, of how deep this went. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I think I came across Dave Cherry's blog spot.
Yeah.
I think it's called How I Was Spiritually Raped and Left to Die.
Yeah, Seeking in Tongues. Yeah.
Seeking in Tongues, yes. And that's the name of the accounts or the story on it. That I was like, wow, okay, this is a story with deep roots. And then it was just a process of finding people from the 70s, from the 80s, from the 90s. Everyone I spoke to unlocked some other part of it. Meeting you was honestly integral to this process, and you helped plug in so many of the gaps. And but you know, it's just hard to get a handle on because there's so many different eras, so many different players. You know, but then all of it linked by Bob Meehan and by this pretty much unchanging sobriety philosophy, which has been, you know, in place without alteration since 1971 in these programs.
Yeah, so that's how it all began.
That was the beginning. Sorry, it's a long response.
No. I knew it would be a long response. It's totally fine. I just remember there were so many times we would be talking and you'd be like, wait, hold on. Start over.
No, that was the quintessential sort of experience of reporting this was me saying, what? And then, you know, and that in every call I had, there was some moment where I was like, wait a minute, go back. And and you know, there's still so much stuff that wasn't even in the article that could make up an entire other, I mean, you know, it could be a book. There's so much there, much craziness. And, you know, I didn't even really in the piece, and I kind of regret this, but there was no way to really get it in there, talk too much about what goes on at, you know, let's say Cornerstone in the last 20 years, talking about what goes on at Crossroads. Got to talk about kind of Mike Weiland and his wife, whose name escapes me, and
Amy.
And talk more about Frank Zacta, who I spoke to a few times, but not substantively. There's still so much.
Did you ever talk to Josh?
To Josh Azevedo, right, and that's another kind of key figure here that was not. I never spoke to him. I never did. No.
Yeah, he's
doesn't
slippery.
Even come up in the article. Yeah, it's interesting. And this is what I mean. There's just so much that didn't fit in, despite this article being like insanely long.
I mean, 50 years. It's a lot. There's a lot that happened, and that that's the other thing with kind of the direction I'm going right now with the podcast. And, I'm going to be putting the audio and some video like ours up on YouTube, and I'm going to start, streaming it live on Twitch, and, and I'm going to start a Discord server. Yeah. Like I'm trying to get, because the last time I was in the Survivors Facebook group, there were between 700 and 800 people. There's probably more now. And I'm like, that's probably one millionth of the amount of people who are out there.
I mean, it's tens of thousands when you think about it.
Easily.
Going back to the 70s. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a huge, including some. So what, another thing that didn't fit in the piece is that in the 1970s, and this is basically not related to anything, the comedian Ron White, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but part of the Blue Collar Comedy Tour.
Yeah,
is a former ES guy.
What?
That is a bit of trivia that I could not fit. I should say an unconfirmed bit of trivia, so it wasn't the piece, so we didn't fact check it. But I do think actually he speaks about it in an article. Yeah, I'm almost positive about that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really feel like I could interview you for much longer, and we could get everything out. And maybe we'll do it
for a part two. Yeah,
yeah, maybe
we'll
do it.
We're barely scratching the surface. Yeah, seriously.
And I mean, it makes me think about like when you were talking about how this was a thought I had a while ago, but you just reminded me of this. How it's so hard to describe the abuse, because you're right. Nobody was beaten up. They weren't locking us in rooms. Now we are hearing of some really sick shit that's happening to people, but that's usually at the hands of, the kids in the group are, that guy that posted on the Meehan Survivors Instagram, who was tied up and raped with a broom handle, and
I missed that. That's awful.
Yeah, it's horrific. And the staff has always been able to distance themselves from things like that because it happened, at a bunch of guys were just hanging out, and it was meant to be this initiation hazing kind of thing. And that's how they've always kind of been able to be like, well, we're dealing with the sickest of the sick and we're dealing with drug addicts. And it's like, first of all, no, you're not. First of all, Section A, you have no right to be diagnosing anyone as anything, much less drug addicts, adolescents. So those things do happen. But as far as like the staff and how they treat people in the group, like, you're right, there's no physical abuse happening. At least not anymore. I've heard in the 80s, there were ashtrays thrown at people and shit, but they stopped doing that.
Sure.
And so it is, I think that is what has held people back a lot, because it's like, because number one, you're so like, part of the psychological abuse is, if you can't handle being humiliated and made fun of and messed with, you're too sensitive and you need to get thicker skin and whatever. So I think that's what a lot of people are kind of left with when they leave, is like they still have that like, well, I can't say anything about any of that because it just means I'm a pussy,
Yeah, no, it's like a toxic mindset. It's horrible. This sort of Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, well, no, that's okay. And it's just, it's hard to explain to people. And it's hard to say, like, you know, like, for me, like, it's hard to say, like, I was abused, you know? And and I was interviewing, I'm posting a really good interview on Friday. God, it was so good. And we were talking about, you know, her experience in the group. And I knew her, I was her sponsor. I was her quote unquote counselor. And mm-hmm. she and I were really close. And so it was a different experience for me interviewing her because I was there for a lot of the stuff she was talking about, you know? And I was the abusive staff that she was talking about, you know? So it was a trip, but it was really good.
Yeah. That's such a facet of this, is that so many of the people I've spoken to who are against this program and who are reckoning with the damage it's done to them have this kind of baggage from feeling like they, you know, were unkind to other people.
Complicit.
They participated in this, complicit in the system. And I mean, you know, at the same time, so many of you came in when you were kids and so many of you sort of, I mean, came in at a really vulnerable time in your lives. I mean, the only people that I really see as having real culpability and blame, and even, you know, well, certainly Bob Meehan and his wife, without a doubt, and then, you know, the program directors too, and some of the counselors. But the even in the case of some of the program directors, I mean, you can say on the one hand that they some of them are irredeemable, but then also it's kind of sad in a way, because, you know, who knows what kind of person they'd be or what their lives would be if they hadn't gotten caught up in this at such a young age, you know? But yeah, I mean, it's certainly what I've heard about some of these directors. I mean, it would be hard, I would imagine, for anyone to forgive them in any real way.
Yeah. Well, and when she and I were talking, one of the things that happened is I realized I realized the situation that happened where I was broken and where I stopped trusting myself and where I had to start complying in order to survive there. And I don't want to get too much into the situation because I get into it in detail, but it was the first time I ever really realized that. Like, I had always kind of seen myself as, you know, because I'm autistic and because one of the facets of autism is that you mirror people, you know, and you're kind of a chameleon so that you fit in your surroundings in order to, you know, survive, especially if your surroundings are abusive. And I've been doing that my whole life. You know, my family was really abusive. So that was something that I knew how to do really well. And I'd always kind of just assumed from day one that I had done that thing, you know, that I had just kind of mirrored. And I didn't. Like, I raised hell when I was an outpatient because there were a lot of things I didn't like. And a lot of things that, like, did not make logical sense to me, because none of it makes logical sense. Right. And I there was this one time that I raised hell, and the entire steering committee, most of who are now staff members who've been there for over 20 years, pulled me aside and just shredded me. And just, it was like, you don't know what you're talking about. You're, you know, a newcomer, you're newly sober, and you need to listen to us. And like, and by the end of it, I was sobbing. I was hysterical. And then it was like, see, this is what's really going on. You're hurting and you're sad. And this is an uncomfortable situation from you. And I was like, oh my God, that was the first time I went, I can't trust myself. I can't trust my thinking. I can't trust my instincts.
Right.
And that was really the last time that I kind of raised hell like that. Now, I definitely, you know, I was always called rebellious, you know, and my rebellion was a, you know, a character defect and part of my disease. And because every now and then I'd be like, hold on a fucking minute, you know, like, like, I think you're wrong, you know, but I would always be beaten back down. And I'm really glad that side of me was always there. Because that's what got me out. you know?
Absolutely.
But it was absolutely beaten down and treated as a problem and an obstacle to my happiness, as opposed to, like, it's just logical. It's not anything special.
It's to just the situation.
Logical.
Yeah.
Right. Logical, right. Rational thinking.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that you kept that part of yourself alive through that process, that kind of more skeptical or questioning part. Because I know that, as you know, some people do not.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's lucky or not luck. I mean, I'm sure, you know, you have to fight to kind of keep that part of yourself alive too. And if you don't actively realize you're doing it, but.
Yeah. And I think my dad dying, I always say it flipped a switch, and that's really what it felt like. Like, after my dad died, I was like, it was just so devastating, and I wasn't really allowed to grieve it properly. Because my dad died and I broke up with this guy that I was like dating. And so it was a lot all at the same time.
Yeah.
And I was really struggling, It was, you know, like, well, why are you having such a hard time with this? And you need to just, you know, I remember Josh Acevedo, basically told me, like, yeah, when my mom died, I just had to laugh about it. And I just had to make fun of it a lot. So I remember I was running older group outpatient when my dad died. And so when he died, I'd flown back to Atlanta for his funeral. And so they had told the people at my outpatient, like, Jacqueline's dad died, so she's not going to be here for, you know, a week or so. And when I got back, the people at my outpatient were like, hey, I'm so sorry about your dad. And I was like, oh, it's fine. I mean, I'm basically a bastard now, but it's cool. Like, and I remember them being like, okay, like, so like weirded out by it. But I was like, well, this is just how people, you know, who are, you know, on a spiritual plane that's higher than everyone else, this is how we deal with death.
Sure.
And I think because of that, that part of me came out so much stronger, because it was like, no, I'm going to grieve my dad's death. You know, like, you can't talk me out of this devastating grief I'm dealing with. You know, because there was so much tied up with my dad, and I'm not going to get into all of it now. But yeah, I mean, it was just, that was when it happened. And that's when, and I remember thinking to myself, I'm not going to filter what I think anymore. Like, I'm not doing it. And I didn't. And it did not go well.
Yeah.
People were not happy about it, but I had hit this point where I wouldn't let them talk me out of it anymore. And I wouldn't, I was just like, no, you don't have to like what I said. And you can tell me all the reasons why what I said is means I'm fucked up, but I don't care. And I'm not going to stop saying these things. So I think by the time I was like, okay, I think I want to quit, they were like, okay, cool, bye. Because they were sick of dealing with me, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I me too. Like, it was just such a trip to be like, oh my God, I remember that situation. And that's when it happened.
Yeah. I mean, this gets to what we were saying earlier about how hard it is to convey what's so weird about these programs, because what they're doing is, like, I sometimes struggle to see what even the point of it is basically scrambling people's natural reactions to things and, like, rewiring people to make it so that, for instance, you know, a parent's death is not an occasion for serious grief. Or, you know, I mean, there are a million examples of just this bizarre, rewiring of people's instincts to bring them in line with whatever bizarre kind of quasi-ideology this group is espousing and indoctrinating people in.
I know. It's so weird, because it's like, and this is kind of the constant question is, was it intentional? Was it an intentional attempt to control people, or was it just learned? And I think it's so different. Like, I really think for Bob, and it's such a trip now, because we're learning so much about, like, how much of what he'd said about himself and his life was just bullshit.
Right.
And I would, you know, I honestly would love to dig deeper into that. Like, I honestly would love to know, like, where the fuck did this guy come from? You know?
No, he really is like a man from nowhere. That's what I really do find fascinating. I mean, I find it plausible that he probably wasn't in jail, but, or that he had spent time at the kind of narcotics farm, right? Which was that like, prison for drug addicts, an experimental prison where
is that Bellevue or whatever, the one in Baltimore?
No, this is in Kentucky. So he'd always said he'd been
Lexington,
Kentucky.
Yeah.
And it would make sense that he would have gone to the narcotics farm, which is basically where drug addicts were sent with the aim of kind of experimenting on them, and a lot of unethical stuff happened there. But it was a strange kind of historical moment.
Really?
And I think that it seems plausible to me that Bob Meehan came out of there. Which is, I mean, he's someone who really just touches on a whole lot of weird kind of, you know, U.S. history stuff. I don't know. Yeah. He himself, I mean, for all of his evident demerits, is a fascinating person, right? Not a good person
right.
by any stretch of the imagination, but an interesting person. I mean, you kind of want to understand him, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that would be, I think we just need to write a book, Daniel. That's what we need to
do. Let's do it. I'm in. Let's make it happen.
Yeah. It's that's just kind of the constant conundrum is like, because I could think about myself, and by no means was I ever like, I'm in a cult and I'm going to, you know, continue to I'm going to brainwash people or indoctrinate people. Like,
I
never thought that, but
right.
So it's hard for me to imagine that other people were, you know,
right. I mean, I think even on Bob Meehan's part, he probably wasn't thinking that to himself. I think so much. I mean, I've never met him. Just from what I've heard from other people and the kind of limited psychologizing I've done of him, it does seem that he was like so much of what he did. I mean, people brought up Donald Trump a lot. And honestly, there's a similar question there. It's like, is Donald Trump a political genius, or does he just have these kind of bizarrely unerring instincts for what will, you know, keep his people on his side? And it does seem that like Bob Meehan was not much of a thinker, but he was very instinctual. And he had a good kind of sense of what will make someone want his approval. And, you know, I don't know the extent to which he was actively calculating.
Right.
I would love to know.
Yeah, for sure. And I do think like the closest I feel like I've come to an answer is I do think he was just a narcissist. And I think you know, if the story about him being the janitor at the church and Father Charlie putting him in front of a bunch of kids.
That I think is true. That
I think is true. And him getting that attention from both Father Charlie, because if he did grow up in this very religious Irish Catholic family, Father Charlie would have been the ultimate father figure to him, like the ultimate authority. And seeing the attention he got from Father Charlie and from a bunch of teenagers, that would have fed that narcissistic need to always be getting adoration and attention and, you know, like everything we know about narcissists. And then from there, he just did whatever he had to do to continue to be that person so that he could continue to get all of that, you know, all of that attention and adoration.
No, absolutely.
And,
yeah. That's a huge, I mean, you're right. I mean, that's probably the main part of it is that he just wanted that love and he wanted that control over people.
Yeah. And the control. Yeah. And the control.
And the control. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the control is you want to control someone so that they can't stop loving you. And so they can't stop, you know, giving you all their attention.
Yes. Cause narcissists tend to not play the long game, you know, because everything is so much about right here, right now is someone, you know, am I getting the kind of attention and love from someone that I need? But they don't think through the consequences of their actions, you know, and they don't think through, like, if I tell this person this story right now, if it ever comes out that it's not true, that's going to end their love for me, you know, because every time he talked about this stuff, like when all the stuff happened in 2005, it was always, why is everybody so mad at me? Why does everyone hate me so much? It was never, why do they think I'm harming people? You know what I mean? Like, that would be my first concern, would be like, oh shit, have I like hurt a bunch of people that I care about?
No, he seemed to like have this kind of mental block that a lot of, you know, as we said, narcissists have, which is an inability to comprehend the other person's perspective and an inability to assimilate the idea that they might have acted in the wrong in some way, even if they weren't trying to. And I'm sure he was trying to a lot of the time.
Right. Right.
Or not. I mean, I, you know, as this kind of a truism, bad people never think of themselves as bad.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure that he often thought that he was doing the right thing per his own demented worldview.
Yeah. I agree. I think he did.
Yeah.
Oh, we have hit time. Yes. Sorry about that. I was watching our timer on the recording, and then it just hit me like, oh, I didn't start recording when talking.
Listen, we're just getting started. I mean, I'm down for a round two. We can meld them together, one mega episode.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to do this again. I'm seeing more than a round two. There could be a round three or a round four.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I do have to say, you know, when you were interviewing me, and I think you said you had something like 20 hours of
audio
just for me, is that we developed this like friendship, and I just really enjoy talking to you in general.
Same here. So. The feeling is mutual. Seriously. Yeah.
So I think that
I was gonna say that that's been one of the kind of cool things about doing this article is I feel like I've made actual friends, you know?
Yeah.
Which hasn't really happened to me with anything I've done before. Like this.
Yeah. It's because we're all really cool people.
Honestly, yes, I would agree with that entirely. You guys are right. It's unbelievable how nice everyone has been. I mean, you know, I haven't gotten anyone who's just been like, maybe one person, but that was a different context, who just says like, fuck you, leave me alone. You know, people have been, I mean, you know, this article that I wrote is only the sum of what other people would tell me, right? I mean, that's nonfiction. It's not like, it doesn't exist without people opening up.
Yeah, so. For sure. All right. Well, we will end for today. This has been fantastic.
Yeah, this has been great. Seriously.
And listeners, we will do this again. You will hear from Daniel again.
I'm excited.
Me too. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed Daniel. And like we said there at the end, we are definitely going to do more interviews together, hopefully have, you know, two or three parts, because there's just so much to talk about. And I personally would like to get a little bit more into the man behind the computer, the man behind the article, and get to know Daniel a little bit more outside of just his work on, you know, Enthusiastic Sobriety programs and survivors and things like that. So I hope that you enjoyed it as much as he and I did. And like I said in the beginning, you know, of course, we've got some great episodes coming out. Hang in there. Keep your notifications on. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, because we'll be putting stuff up there. And there may be some original content going up there. I'm working on some things right now, so that'll be pretty cool. If you have feedback, be nice. Please. I am a person. I'm a human being with feelings. So if you have feedback, that's fine. Just be nice about it. Or you want to be on an episode, or you have information that you want to impart, or a story you want to tell, you can now text or call our hotline. It's 404-537-2392. You can be totally anonymous if you want to. We may play some of the voicemails on the podcast. So if you don't want us to do that with your voicemail, say that in the voicemail. Or if you don't want us to mention your name, or if you want us to bleep anything out or alter your voice, we can do all of those things. So that's what that is for. It is not a suicide or crisis hotline. If you're interested in either of those things, if you go to our Linktree, and that's linktree.com/onthems, there are some resources and some text chat lines and phone lines that are specifically for crisis, you know, outreach and suicide ideation. So that's what, you know, all of those things are available to you. And as always, if you like the podcast, please go and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It's the best way to get our podcast kind of popped to the top of the cult/true crime genre, which there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of podcasts in that genre. So the higher up we can get, the more eyeballs we can get on Enthusiastic Sobriety and the abuse that happens there. So that's our ultimate goal. And I want to thank my producer, Adam. I want to thank all the people who are brave enough to come on this podcast and talk about their experience. Y'all are seriously, you're just so inspiring, and I adore you. And I want to thank all the listeners. I want to thank all the people who are, you know, helping these people have a voice and have an impact by listening and sharing and spreading the information. And as always, if you would also like to contact us via email, it's on themspod@gmail.com. Our social media accounts are on the MS on both Instagram and Facebook. I do have someone running the Facebook page now, so I don't personally have to be on Facebook. So we do have the Enthusiastic Sobriety Survivors and On the MS Podcast both have their own Facebook page. You can find us there. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Reddit. We do have a Reddit community. It's On the MS Pod or On the MS on Reddit. So you can check us out there. I'll post episode stuff and probably some like outtakes and things like that just because they're fun. And I think I already said YouTube. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel. If you liked the Twitch episode, go follow us on Twitch. And that's it for now. I will talk to you all soon. Stay safe out there. Take care of yourselves. Bye.